John Constantine, a Hellblazer podcast.
Hey everybody, and welcome back. Before we get into the episode, just want to let you know that this is the free version of the podcast, and all that means is that we are way behind where I'm at in Patreon. So if you are loving this podcast and you need more John Constantine in your life, definitely go check us out at patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks and sign up for the Hellblazer tier, where you'll get access to the entire Hellblazer library that I've recorded so far. And also, you get access to the exclusive episodes of the Planes, Trains, and Comic Books main podcast. So if any of that sounds good to you, definitely go over to patreon.com/planestrainsandcomicbooks, all one word, and sign up there. And with that out of the way, let's get into the issue. Today we are reading Hellblazer number 62. And just a little recap on what happened in the last issue. We've been following John through a story arc called Guys and Dolls, where the First of the Fallen has been trying to figure out how to get around the deal he made with John when John was trying to figure out how to cure his cancer. And one way he thought he could do that was to get at a demon named Chantinelli that John was friends with. She was able to escape from hell and get away from him, and she came to John for help. We learned that this was not the first time she had come to John for help, because 4 years ago, she came to John with an angel who she was in love with, and they were both in love with each other, actually, and she was actually pregnant with the angel's baby, and this was going to be a problem, and she needed John to hide them. John, unfortunately, wasn't successful in hiding them from all of the people that were after her, and her love, the angel Tali, was killed by some heavenly hosts, and the baby was born and then taken from her. So it didn't go too well the first time, but she doesn't have any other options when the First is after her. So she does go to John again, and this time he is able to help her out. He actually carves a sigil onto her soul, and this sigil hides her from hell and any demons within. And we left the last issue with her having a clean slate, and then also her owing John some sort of favor. And that catches us up to where we're at now with issue 62. So first things first, we got the cover. We see John is by the ocean. He's on the coastline and he's in a cemetery and he's got a shovel and it looks like he's about to dig up his own grave because it says Constantine on the headstone. And besides the Constantine one, there's a couple more headstones with names on them. And those names are the creators of this issue. We got Garth Ennis on the writing with Steve Dillon on the art. And we start off on the first page on the coastline of Ireland. John is looking out over the ocean and he's in an old cemetery that is on the shoreline. And you can definitely tell that the headstones of all the graves are extremely worn. So this is a really old cemetery. And also there's like what used to be a church, but it's kind of just like a vague shape of a building with no roof. And John is smoking as he looks out over the ocean and the narration says, "There's an old graveyard south of Liverpool, where the Irish Sea spews toxic shit across a lonely shore. No one comes here now, not even to be buried. Nothing wakes the sleepers. Nothing tramps across their beds. Except for nosy bastards like me, of course. Pretty soon now, I'll finish this fag, and I'll pick up the spade. And then I'll start digging." And then we get a full-page splash of John from behind as he's staring out at the ocean. And we see that the grave he's standing next to is, in fact, one that has the name Constantine on it. But like I said earlier, this is a very, very old grave. So this isn't like his dad's grave, and it's definitely not one that at least we've seen before. And we also see on this splash page that the name of this issue is End of the Line. Then we cut to some time earlier where apparently it is around Christmas time, and we see that John and Kit are visiting John's sister, Cheryl, for the holidays. And the narration says, "It was all smiles and hellos when we got to Cheryl's, but I could still feel the ice in the air." So we see John and Kit taking off their jackets as they come in through the door, and we see standing there greeting them is Cheryl and Cheryl's husband, and also Cheryl's daughter Gemma. We haven't seen her in a while. She looks a lot older, like she is maybe just a little under a teenager now. I think the last time we saw her, she was maybe like 7 or 8. So John sees her and he says, "Here, look at the princess." And Gemma replies, "Hello, Uncle John." And Kit is saying to Cheryl, "It's really good of you to ask us up." And Cheryl replies, "Nah, you're welcome anytime, love." So Cheryl goes to put some tea on, and as she does, she looks at John like with side eye, and John notices and kind of excuses himself and says he's going to give her a hand. And as John walks away, Kit turns to Gemma and says, "How are you?" And Gemma kind of sheepishly says, "Hi, Kit. And Kit asks, "You in the doghouse?" Meaning, is she in trouble? And Gemma looks down, kind of sad, and says, "Yeah." Then we cut to John and his sister Cheryl in the kitchen, and John asks, "What's up with you, sis?" And Cheryl replies, "Don't you sis me, sunshine. What have you done to Gemma?" And John's kind of shocked. He says, "What? I only just got here." And Cheryl's not buying it. She says, "John, I'm ready to bloody well smack you one. Now, what sort of badness have you been putting in my little girl's head, for God's sake?" And John still doesn't know what's going on, but he replies, "I haven't seen Gemma for months, Cheryl. I thought you were having us up because it's Christmas next week, not to bite my sodding head off." And then Cheryl turns around and begins digging in a cupboard. And as she does that, she says, "Oh, is that right? Well, what do you call this then?" And she pulls something out of the cover and shows it to John. And we see it in the panel. And basically, it looks like a piece of cardboard or paper that has some sigils and a circle in it. And in the middle of the circle, we see a picture of Gemma and two other girls. And the girl in the middle has a bunch of pushpins shoved into her face. So it definitely looks like some sort of black magic where you're trying to hurt someone in a picture. So John takes the board and he looks at it and he says, "Oh, Jesus. Here, hold on. You think I gave her this?" And Cheryl replies, "Who else?" And John looks at his sister kind of shocked and says, "Bloody hell, Cheryl. I've messed up my life good and proper with this bollocks. Why would I want to do the same to Gemma? She's my niece." And Cheryl looks very angry and says, "She's my daughter." And at this, John walks over and puts his hands on her shoulders as he faces her. And he says, "Oh, Cheryl, I swear to God I didn't give her this, okay? I mean, did she say I did?" And Cheryl replies, "No, she won't tell me anything about it." And John asks, "Do you want me to help her?" And at that, Cheryl just looks up at him kind of like, "No, I do not." Then we cut to a little while later as they all sit in the living room and drink tea. And Kit is sitting next to Cheryl on the couch. And her husband, Tony, is sitting in his own chair, kind of in the same room with them, but he's actually listening to music, which is kind of rude. I don't know why you'd have company over and you're just listening to music. But at least he's listening through headphones and not bothering everybody else with the noise. So the last time we saw Cheryl was actually when John was dying from lung cancer. And when he thought there was no way out of it and he was definitely going to die, he went to all of his family members and friends and basically said his last goodbyes to them. So Cheryl is talking to Kit on the couch and she's saying, "And when he came back after he said we wouldn't see him again, I mean, I thought he was starting to sort himself out. But I found Gemma with that thing, and he was the first one I thought of, you know?" And Kit replies, "Of course I do, Cheryl. But your wee brother, you know what he's like. You and Gemma are a real comfort to him. He wouldn't hurt you in a million years, love." And hearing this really reaffirms that John didn't do this to Cheryl, so she kind of cheers up a little bit and says, "Oh, but you too, Kit. You've been brilliant for him." And Kit doesn't really say anything to that, but she does ask, "So does Tony know about all this?" And Cheryl kind of looks down and answers, "Oh God, no. It'd destroy him in the state he's in." And I'm not exactly sure what they're talking about here because we haven't really seen Tony and Cheryl for a while. Tony has always been kind of an idiot. We did see them fall into like a crazy cult that was going on in the first couple issues of Hellblazer. But I'm not sure what other state they're talking about other than he just seems kind of complacent and not really present as a father or a husband in the family. And the last panel on this page actually shows kind of how complacent he is because he's just sitting there staring away from Kit and Cheryl, smiling to himself as he listens to music. Then we cut to John and Gemma and we're in her bedroom and they're sitting on the bed. And Gemma looks kind of nervous and scared. She's actually like got her hands tucked away in between her legs and she's looking down. And in between them on the bed, we see the board with all the magical symbols and the pictures on it. And Gemma is saying, "Sandra's been really horrible to me, Uncle John. She nicked Barry off me at Tina's party and all. And she's meant to be my friend." And John says, "She's the one the pins are on in the photo, yeah? Gem, where did you get this?" And then Gemma begins to cry and she says, I can't say. He said he put a curse on me." And at hearing this, John gets very mad and he says, "A curse? Who said it, love? What's his name?" And then John's narration underneath that says, "Because right then I wanted to know what to put on the Frigger's grave. Dad's ghost and the man. I mean, hadn't the kid been put through enough?" And what he's talking about there is a couple issues where the ghost of John's dad and her grandpa was visiting her. And then also, I think it's issue 3 or 4. It's called Waiting for the Man. And it was when Gemma was almost taken by a child serial killer and John barely saved her before she was murdered by him. So I guess because John got very serious and asked for his name, Gemma breaks down and says, "Oh God, Robbie Brooks." And then we get a flash of what Robbie Brooks looks like and we see maybe like an 18-year-old kid who's got a jacket on, kind of like John Constantine, and he's wearing a shirt with a pentagram. He's got a cigarette in one hand and a beer in the other, and he's smiling, and it's like he's at a party because Gemma's remembering. And he's kind of a stocky young man, and he's got a flat top haircut, but he also has like a mullet, so it's definitely 90s. And Gemma says, "He's Tina's brother. I thought he was just a dickhead, like, but he came up to me when I was angry at the party. He told me he could help me get back Cassandra, showed me all these books and everything. It looked like devil worship stuff, with all these Latin stars and writing, you know? And he gave me the board and made me swear not to tell. Someone took the photo at the party. Robbie said it was good for the magic. I was just about to prick my thumb and put blood on it, and then Mom walked in. She nearly had a fit." And then we see John's narration says, "Thank Christ." I think in regards to that the ceremony was interrupted and she did not put her blood on that picture. So then Gemma goes over to John and gives him a hug and says, "I'm sorry." And John says, "It's okay, love. It's okay. I'll fix everything up, right?" And then he asks her, "Gem, you're a smart kid, love. Why'd you want to mess about with this crap?" And she answers, "Well, I don't know. I thought I could get Sandra. I know it was sort of wicked-like, but it was also sort of exciting, too." And upon hearing that the magic was a little bit exciting to Gemma, John's face gets kind of tight, like he's worried about her. So as they finish her hug, the mom, Cheryl, comes in and says, "Well, how's my little monster, then?" And Gemma asks, "You're not mad at me?" And Cheryl says, "No, of course she's not." And she goes over to Gemma and gives her a big hug. And then John leaves that room and shuts the door behind them. And he sees Kit waiting outside. And she says, "Well?" And John answers, "Some bastard's trying to get her into magic. Jesus, it's just like I started out. They make you think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'll have to sort this wanker out. And then I'll put the fear of God into Gemma so she stops it here. Ah, shit." And then Kit says, Why don't you let me talk to Gemma?" Then we cut to John, who's at someone's front door at a housing building that looks pretty run down. There's broken windows. Looks like there's some plaster missing off the facade. And we get some narration from John that says, "On the other side of Liverpool and half a packet of Silk Cut later, I found the squat where Brooks was supposed to live. Anger makes things seem easy. Go out, fix the bastard, feel better, go home. If only." And then we see a young man answer the door that John is knocking on, and John is saying, "I'm looking for a lad called Brooks." And the young man is saying, "So what?" But John just pushes through him and walks straight into the house and says, "Piss off, bollocks." And the boy yells after him, "I'm not afraid of you, pal. I do karate." But John doesn't pay any attention to him. He just walks straight into the kitchen where he sees Robbie Brooks sitting and he says, "You're Brooks? You're the one who gives curse boards to kids, huh?" And Robbie Brooks turns around and says, "What? Have you been talking to that master's bitch?" And John does not like that. He says, "She's my niece, you fat pile of shit. Watch it." And then the young man turns around and says, "You're Jesus, John Constantine in my house?" And then we see John's narration says, "Oh, bloody hell." So Robbie stands up all excited and he says to his friend, "Saw it off, Brian. This is important." And then he turns to John and says, "This is freaking great, John. I've always wanted to meet you. Terry Butcher's been telling me loads about you. I think I've still got that magazine with the membrane interview, too. Come on and see." And then he pushes open a door, which I'm assuming is to his room. And as John follows behind him, he's thinking, "I thought Butcher got eaten backstage at Live Aid. Christ, I hadn't counted on this prick knowing so much about me." So as John enters into the young man's room, he pushes Robbie onto the floor and says, "Right, you stupid bastard. Do you know what would have happened if she put blood on that board?" And Robbie's confused. He says, "What? Why are you angry with me? I mean, she'd be doing the stuff you do. Why aren't you proud?" And every time someone mentions that Gemma would just be doing the stuff that John does, he gets very angry because he does not want Gemma to follow down that path. And John's narration says, "No, it wasn't going to be easy. It was more than some little turd getting his kicks by screwing up kids." And then Robbie stands up and kind of sheepishly says, I mean, what did I do wrong, huh?" And then a very angry John says, "Shut up." And then he raises his hand and says, "Corvus Inferni, Districulum Canavaris, Oculari Arca del Maleficium Cariandum." And Robbie says, "What?" And John answers, "Thrice bound, thrice cursed, thrice damned." And as he's saying this, Robbie is saying, "No, stop, no!" And then John very calmly pulls out a cigarette and lights it and says, "Sacred Arcana, Magus stuff." And Robbie gets super scared and he yells out, "Oh God!" And then John just turns around and begins to walk out and he says, "If you ever go near Gemma Masters again, arsehole, you'll find out what a real curse is." And then Robbie begins to run after him begging, Oh God, oh no, please. And John doesn't even turn around to acknowledge him. He just says, no point in begging, son. You can't reverse high magic. And as Robbie screams, pleading behind him, John's narration says, to be honest, it was just a load of shit I made up off the top of my head. It's good enough for him, though. So John leaves, and then we get a last panel of Robbie in the center of his sparse room, curled up in the fetal position, and he's saying, please, please, please. Then we cut to Kit and Gemma, and it seems that Kit has taken Gemma out for a shopping trip. They're at a clothing store, and Gemma is trying on a jacket, and she says, oh, Kit, it's brilliant. Are you sure, like? And Kit answers, aye, your Uncle John wanted you to have something nice for Christmas. I'm telling you, Gemma, you're going to knock him dead in that. And Gemma replies, thanks. You're dead good together, you two. I mean, John never really lasted with anyone before, you know? And then as they walk up to the cash register to check out with the jacket, Kit asks, did you know many of his other girlfriends? And Gemma replies, well, Emma was up with him a few times, but I was only little then. She was nice. And then as they walk out of the store, Gemma continues, but me mom, right? She thinks you're great, she does. She says you're Uncle John's last chance. And Kit replies, she does now. Sometimes people are just themselves, not what other people hope they'll be. Here, do you fancy a pizza? And Gemma says she does, so they go to the pizza restaurant, and as they're sitting at a booth, Gemma is saying, I'm really glad you two came, you know. Me mam's been flaming with me. And Kit replies, ah, Gemma, you nearly terrified the life out of her. And Gemma replies, yeah, but it's just the same kind of thing John does, isn't it? And I'm going to mention something that's been going on this whole time, and I'm not sure if it means anything or matters, but I'm going to say it because there's definitely something going on with Kit staring off in the distance as she's talking to people. Earlier on, I didn't mention it because I wasn't sure if it was just art or something, but whenever Kit talks to someone in this issue, she'll say one thing to their face, and then the next panel, she's staring off as if she's looking at someone who's following them or if she's heard something, just like her attention's been caught by something, and she turns her head, and then she turns back to continue the conversation. So she does this head look away thing as she says, I wouldn't know. Replying to Gemma about John doing the same kind of magic stuff. And then she turns her head back to Gemma and says, just because I'm living with John doesn't mean I like what he gets up to. And Gemma says, I thought you'd be into it too. And then Kit gives a little smile and says, nah, but he doesn't mind. He keeps it away from me. He knows I'm not interested in that side of him anyway. He doesn't put up a front or try to be clever. I just care about him, Gemma. And Gemma replies, oh, that's really nice. You must know what he's really like then, yeah? And Kit asks, don't you? And then when Gemma doesn't give an answer, Kit says, he's good to you, Gemma. He brings you presents and all, and he helps you out, and he talks to you. And whatever it is that's wrong with him, he stops it hurting you. That's him. And Gemma says, yeah, I suppose so. It's just, if this magic is, well, wrong or whatever, it just sounds really wild, you know? And Kit replies, oh, aye. John's done plenty of wild things, Gemma. He's been all over the world. He's seen incredible stuff. He's had the time of his life. And then for effect, Kit kind of pauses, and we get some cool panels where when she said the last thing, we saw half of Kit's face looking very serious. And then as Kit says this next thing, we see Gemma's face with her eye really wide like she's scared, and it's really close up. And Kit continues, and he's caused a terrible, terrible lot of pain while he's been at it. That's why he was worried about you, love. He doesn't want you mucking up your life the way he did. And as they finish their meal, they stand up, and as they're about to leave, Gemma says, oh, I'm sorry. I was just so mad at Sandra. Like, I didn't want to let her get off with it. And surprisingly, to this, Kit replies, just right, too. And Gemma's a little confused because she thinks that Kit didn't want her to use magic to hurt her. And Kit turns around and says, you should never take shit off anyone, Gemma. I never did. But you don't need magic or whatever. Get angry if you want. Chin the wee bitch. Just make sure people know who you are and what you're about. And that they better not try any old cuteness. And then Gemma asks, is that what you did? And Kit answers, it is. And look who I ended up with. And they both have a little chuckle about that. Then we cut back to John, and he's in the cemetery from the beginning, so I guess we've gone full circle now with the story. And he's actually digging up in front of the grave that says Constantine, and his narration says, it's something in me I've always known about, but never had the balls to face. A vicious, twisted little shit of a thing that scrambles in the dark and giggles to itself. It can kill a child in the womb, or hurt a little girl just because she's the wrong guy's niece. I call it fate. So I've come here to find an expert on the subject. And John has dug out in front of this grave a perfect rectangle that would be the size of a person's body. And he's only about 3 feet down, and he's already like sore from digging. And he says, Christ, I should have brought Chaz for this. And then he lights a cigarette, and as he does, someone below him says, "You can stop digging now, you little bastard. I'm free." And we cut to a panel of a corpse rising from the muddy ground underneath Constantine's feet. And as he's pulling himself up out of the ground, he says, "You almost cut me in two with that cursed spade, you fool." And John replies, "Tough shit." And the corpse gets a kick out of this and says, "I see the family charm is as strong in you as ever. It's been 20 years, has it not? Did your life turn out to be the magical triumph you expected?" And John seems annoyed at this question, and he doesn't answer. And we see the corpse with a big grin on his face because he just pissed off Constantine. And he continues, "It happens to all of us. We get a sniff of sorcery, and oh, what plans we make. We'll shake creation and leave nothing but smiles and wit and a reputation all men envy." And then he pauses and he begins to chuckle, saying, "Us Constantines." And as John stares at him, we get a flashback and we get some narration saying, "I knew I wasn't the first Constantine to do weird shit. A quick deco at the history books told me that. But old Brendan, always the scholar, found me an ancestor who was still alive. Harry Constantine served with Cromwell in Ireland at the Drogheda Massacre. But where God's friggin' Englishmen did it out of good Christian madness, Harry did it for the loot. And then he met his match in the Ribbon Queen, and she cursed the bastard to live forever." So over this section, we're getting a portrait of like a 1500s or something man in armor, and he looks just like John, except for the clothes he's wearing, of course, is of the time period. Then we get a panel of Harry Constantine being buried alive, and the narration continues. "The spell wasn't that strong, just bloody amateur stuff. If someone wanted to, they could still do him in. So the queen put him somewhere no one could get to him." Then we see a panel of his grave covered, and there is no first name on the grave. It just says Constantine. And the narration continues. "No one did. Not for 300 years. And then one day, along comes this arrogant little sod asking about his heritage. He knows what a shit Harry is, and once he's got his answers, he just fills in the grave again." And this is a cool panel because we see a young teenage John Constantine, and he's got long hair, but he still has the same swagger, and he's just a little bit smaller in stature. And just like the narration said, we see that the corpse isn't fully uncovered, so like a little jerk, John just buried him after he asked him the question. And the narration continues. "He thinks he's going to be different, but he's not. He's John Constantine." So apparently while John was remembering back, he was just smoking and not saying anything, so the corpse breaks the silence saying,
"Well, more guidance and history? Is that what you want from me? A bloody fine nerve you have after the last time."
And then John smiles and says, "Let's get out of this sodding hole, huh?" So as John pulls the corpse out of the grave, the corpse is asking,
"What right had you to sit in judgment over me? Or have you ended up with bloodless hands? You'd be the friggin' first."
And then John sits down on the pile of dirt next to the grave. And as the corpse stands up, John says, "No, I haven't. I still don't know what kind of fate it is that makes us into bastards. I thought I came close once, but I know it tries to get us all. Us Constantines. But there's something else we do. We all try to buck fate, right down to the last drop of blood. We struggle all the way. Stillborn friggers." And the corpse says,
"Maybe it's all we've got."
And John's narration says, "Maybe it is." And then we see the two men kind of staring into the ocean as they think about the fate of the Constantine bloodline. Then the corpse breaks the silence by saying,
"I'll come to a point of choice. I think your niece has reached hers. And if she hasn't already turned from the path of the damned, a few good words from you should do the trick."
And John replies, "I think that's already sorted, mate." And the corpse says,
But now the wind is freshening and the stars are slipping back between the clouds. We've let a moment's warmth put off decision's chill. I don't want to go back below, John. Bastard though I am, I want to rest."
And then John kind of chuckles and says, "You're a bastard, all right, Harry. But one bastard can forgive another. Who else will?" And then John and Harry's corpse kind of smile at each other. And then we get a faraway shot where we see John has swung the shovel and he's hitting the head off of Harry, which I guess kills him because that spell was weak, like John said. So all you had to do was decapitate him, kind of like a Highlander or something. And his narration says, "And there's just a tiny murder in the night. I thought I'd be admitting my life was a failure, wanting to end the line. I bucked fate. I beat it. It's no failure to be the last Constantine, because now no one else has to be." And as John was saying this last stuff, we see him walking into Cheryl's house, and then he goes upstairs to Gemma's room, and he kind of peeks in to make sure that she's okay, and then he closes the door and he walks away. So I guess he's very happy that Gemma has turned away from magic, at least for now. And then also, it seems that, and we kind of figured this out already, but it seems that John doesn't want to pass on his bloodline, like he doesn't want to have kids. So he seems to have made that decision, and he's come to terms with it not being a failure, but it's actually like a good thing, because then this cursed line of blood won't go on longer. And that is the end of the issue. So if you guys have any comments, questions, or suggestions, you can email me at planestrainsandcomicbooks, all one word, at gmail.com, and we will see you on the next one.